breaks out, nothing but silence. From the mainstream media show, we want to know about nonviolence. Where do we go? Nonviolence radio. Tell your friend, tell your foe.
Ooh, nonviolence radio.
Challenging silence.
Nonviolence radio.
Challenging silence.
Ooh, nonviolence radio.
Challenging silence.
Now let's get into nonviolence radio. Nonviolence is, as Gandhi said, not the inanity that it's been taken to be throughout the ages. It's actually an entire culture, and it's a power that when we learn to access it from within and then to apply it to the situations in the world, we have no doubt can solve every problem that humanity is facing today, from climate issues related to man-made caused climate issues to issues such as war and violence between human beings. So it's a huge area of study, and we've dedicated 1 hour every other week to exploring it in the culture. And today on the show, we are joined by Amy Robinson, who's a local Sonoma County poet, because listen, people say that poetry is not practical. Either you have this is poetry, but let's get into what is really at stake here. And I want to challenge that assumption today by bringing a poet, activist, mother, Zen practitioner here in the studio to talk politics and nonviolence and poetry with us. So first of all, welcome to Nonviolence Radio, Amy.
Thank you very much.
Now, you were invited recently to write a love poem to Kellyanne Conway. Let's just start with that, because this was a part of this challenge of the discussion on fake news. And so as we're going to be exploring nonviolence and the news and so forth, what motivated you to write a love poem? What was this challenge? And let's hear it.
So the challenge over the past few months has been to not be obsessed by the news and to find some way to be constructive and authentic in my response to the news. Mm-hmm. And right around Valentine's Day, I was completely obsessed with Kellyanne Conway. I was watching every single video that I came across of her, sometimes multiple times, just totally fascinated by her. And on Valentine's Day, the Women's March organizers put out a call that spend this Valentine's Day exploring revolutionary love. Mm. And write letters to your congresspeople out from a place of revolutionary love, and, you know, put that into action on Valentine's Day this year. And so it popped into my head that probably the most revolutionary thing I could do was to try to empathize with Kellyanne Conway, who was driving me crazy. So I just sat down and I started writing a love poem to her, and it ended up getting accepted by this really amazing program called Poets Respond that's done by Rattle, a literary journal called Rattle, where they publish poems every week that respond to the news. So,
would you mind sharing it with us?
Sure. Okay. Yesterday, we were asked to write from a place of revolutionary love, so I tried to write a love poem to Kellyanne. Oh, Kellyanne, I have waited a lifetime to see you at a loss for words. Your tired pauses on today were pregnant with the chance you might slow down or change your mind. That vague breeze that wafts behind you in the White House leaves, does it brush your gilded hair and offer you whispery versions of truth when the questions come? They keep coming, the questions. Damn them, right? You might wake, Kellyanne, one of these days and catch a small feeling in the back of what I hope is a muscular heart, a rough shadow of loneliness or a soupçon of regret. Perhaps, perhaps not. You're a free agent, Kellyanne. You offer yourself up to the temples of information, and they take you with your thick-lashed, sleepy eye, your slippery seizure of words, your knowing smile. And yet, And yet, today your fatigue defeated you, and I watched with a not very conflicted heart. You've been cast out from some of the dens you relished hunting in, and I study every frozen image that drifts across my screen to detect some modicum of hurt. Does it hurt, Kellyanne? It's true, almost every image of you is a headshot, skin-taut, you suspended in vocal televisual motion, your chirpy stream of words stripped away, and what is left is just what is left of you, which isn't much. A thin-boned, matronly waif, glaring blue shadow. Oh, Kellyanne, you looked much healthier in the summertime. It hurts to watch you disintegrate. It's not a zero-sum world. If you get better, maybe we'll all get better together. But first, you have to stop lying. Kellyanne, I'm trying to find you. In my good moments, I could even try to love you, let you be my shadow. But your foxhole scares me, and the circles under your eyes make me feel almost inexpressibly sad.
That was Amy Robinson. She's here in the studio with us today here on Nonviolence Radio, bridging the gap between poetry and activism. Michael Nagler, you have something to respond?
It's not very profound, I'm afraid. I was very, very moved by the poem, but it suddenly struck me as a radio person. Does everyone know who Kellyanne Conway is? Maybe we should say a word about her.
Okay, go ahead, Michael.
Well, I'd have a hard time being quite accurate about it, but she is a spokeslady for the president. And she is one of these tragic people who is trapped in a world of lies, therefore. And I had similar experiences, Amy, watching George Shultz in the earlier White House, mm-hmm. because he was a man who seemed to have some depth and some conscience. And I just watched the torture in his face, which I guess most people cannot see. And so she is a person who is vilified and hated by many of our political persuasion or our moral persuasion, and it was an extremely brave act that you did. And I have to say, it was also something that I think we in the resistance world are beginning to recognize as absolutely essential, that we've partly created the problem that we're in by our disrespect for these people. And it is, you know, it was relatively easy to dismiss them, mock them, laugh at them. Well, they're going to have the last laugh unless we change our ways. And I think it's up to us to change them. I don't think they are going to change them without some kind of humane response from us.
Yeah, I had to kind of think of her as almost like a shadow queen. I realized at the time that I wrote that poem, Andy Borowitz of The New Yorker, who does satire, really brilliant satire there, he wrote a piece about Kellyanne. And then there was a piece in The New York Times by a feminist journalist about how she had watched Kellyanne over the years and how brilliant she was and how much it hurt, really, to see what had happened. And so it just felt like it was my obsession, but it also was like a bigger thing that was happening with people trying to understand her as this piece of this bigger puzzle that we're all in of how could this happen? How could this brilliant, smart woman who just kills every interview? I mean, she knows exactly what to do. There are people who analyze her debate tactics in interviews, and she's amazing at it. Yet she uses it to lie. And it's sad.
Yeah. That's my favorite line of that poem is, but first, Kellyanne, you need to stop lying.
Mm-hmm.
And so will you talk a little bit, Amy Robinson, about that bridge between poetry and activism for you and where you see them come together and why you've chosen poetry as your form of expression at this time, because we met during Occupy.
Mm-hmm.
So we've sort of met on this platform of activism, first of all. And that was around the same time that you began writing poetry, am I right?
It was a little before,
okay.
A little before that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when I knew that the way I was engaging in activism wasn't enough for me, or it wasn't nourishing me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not being effective either in my activism or in my personal life because I was not a nourished person. And so I was very committed to the Occupy movement, and I burnt out big time and just walked away. And but I knew one of the reasons I did leave is because I felt like, aren't we fighting? And there was a lot of that feeling of fighting, you know, aren't we fighting or trying to build a world where everyone feels nourished? Mm. So what am I saying with my life if I'm not actually doing that for myself and I'm not modeling for my children how to do that? So I walked away from that and I started actually pretty intensely practicing Zen. I needed a well to drop into to try to find my own way. And then this is what has happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, you found a good one. You know, Amy, we were friends with Narayan Desai, who grew up in Gandhiji's ashram. And in a famous episode when he was a kid, a teenager, I guess, he took over from his deceased father and was Gandhi's secretary and came to Gandhiji one day and said, you know, I know the work I'm doing for you is very important and I love it, but I feel like I'm not growing. Mm. So what should I do? And Gandhi said, you've already answered your question. Mm. Go on. Get out of here, do something else.
Right.
So, and if Gandhi could say that, who needed so much help, you know, it shows you how profoundly right that is, that we need to be nourishing ourselves and the work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Michael, now I want to bring you in, and you're normally our news anchor, and what I've been experimenting with on Nonviolence Radio now is really weaving together our guest and the news. So, how about you start giving us a little bit of inspiration on what is happening in the world of nonviolence, and Amy and I can help to provide some poetry and analysis and conversation about what's taking place.
Well, that gives me a fantastic idea, Stephanie. I should really write an epic poem every week about them.
You could.
In Homeric hexameters. But you talked about inspiration. There really are some wonderful resources out there. And as usual, I try to do resources, news events, and upcoming events. So there's a book by a journalist, Sarah Jaffe, called Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. And it covers people's movements since the 2008 economic crisis. So it provides a history and an overview of Occupy and the 2011 uprising in Wisconsin, Black Lives Matter, and so on and so forth. And I'd like to just add that one of the things that's happened that's kind of new and very, very desirable and promising in the world of nonviolence in the last, since the year 2000, is the recognition of the need for us to learn from one another. And so a book like this is very timely and very helpful. And nonviolence is not just something that that happens when you feel good. But it's, as you were saying, Steph, it's something that it's a science that you study. Now, the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict, ICNC, has been very active, and they have two fantastic resources that they've come up with recently. One is their ICNC Webinar Digest. You know, they do webinars about every week or every other week, and I think I did one for them back in the early days. Then they improved since then, and they're all on the air, and they're very proud to share a new milestone. It's taken them 2 years of hard work, but they have something called ICNC's Online Resource Library, which now houses materials on civil resistance, which is their term for nonviolence, in 55 languages. Now that's more languages than I know. So if you would look at nonviolent-conflict.org/resource-library, mm-hmm. you will get to it.
And Amy, right before our show today, you were actually talking about a resource book, a new book of poetry by an Iranian poet. And I wonder I really feel like this is a bit of a missing piece in the literature and nonviolence. You know, we see how to start a revolution, but do we have things about how to write a revolutionary poem that can reach into the hearts of people? Do you want to say anything about this book that you felt so passionately about?
Yeah, it was published last year. It's by an Iranian-American woman named Salma Sharif. It's called Look, And she started writing these poems quite a while ago in response to September 11th and Guantanamo and the events of the last, you know, 10, 15 years. What she did is she took a dictionary of terms from the U.S. military, and she began writing short poems to de-euphemize their terms. And there are only two poems in the book that are from that very early period. So I'll just read you one of them. I page through. So one of them is battlefield illumination, on fire, a body running. And the other one that's from that period when she started writing, pinpoint target, one lit desk lamp and a nightgown walking past the window. And she, after she started writing those small poems, she just kept playing with the idea of this language from the U.S. military and how it's kind of colonized our imaginations and our lives and the way we express ourselves. And she has many, many different kinds of poems where she shows how this language works. So she has one called Safe House. The first word of every line is in straight alphabetical order from the S section of the dictionary, and it ends up being this beautiful poem about her father and her relationship with her father. And it's amazing that these words could even be part of his life. I mean, it makes it clear how much these words are part of our lives. So I highly recommend Solma Sharif Look. And if we have time, I'll try to find another one to read.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hope you will. You know, in Hannah Arendt's famous book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, she describes him being asked at his trial, how could you do these things? And he said, our language allowed us to do it. Because, you know, as we say in nonviolence, you cannot injure a person of whose humanity you are fully aware. Mm-hmm. You have to dehumanize that person before you can hurt them. And similarly, we have to mask over what we're doing with our language before we can do it.
Mm. Yeah, and it's definitely been on my mind recently. I have a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old, and they're both extremely curious and wanting to understand what's going on right now. And I've
been... Like curious, like she was asking you,
oh, yeah.
What was the question she asked you?
My daughter, on the way to school today, my 10-year-old daughter asked me, why does Russia have to be a dictatorship?
Right.
And we went from talking about the collapse of the Soviet Union, somehow then ended up talking about the Marshall Plan in one conversation. But I have been feeling so much in the face of the budget proposal from this Republican administration, in the face of the stripping of environmental regulation. It just, none of it makes sense in the language that I try to use with my children. So I've been feeling that kind of hollowing out and struggling to find a language that has integrity that can help them make sense of the world. And I love that the poets are out there doing this every day, trying to find language that has integrity.
Mm.
Yeah.
I was just reading, on another note, I was just reading chapter 4 of Augustine's Confessions yesterday as I was looking over the ocean on a very windy day. And in this chapter, in this book of the Confessions, he talks about language as well in terms of getting to perceive the unity of life in the same way that words, we don't stop with one words when with one word. When a word is over, we pick another and another and another, and we respect each piece of it, but we want to have the whole picture. We want the full sentence. And as a bit of a segue into, again, this deepening our understanding of nonviolence, nonviolence is taking that step back and looking at the full picture. And so we have an event here, we have an action there, and how to see the thread that ties them all together and the energy that's behind all of it as well.
As we we being Stephanie and myself, experienced at a workshop this week. People who have no faith in nonviolence almost always fail to connect the dots between the state of mind that they're in and the behavior that they carry out. And they fail to see all the results of an action. So there were people, when I used to teach nonviolence, I always showed there were people who said that the civil rights movement was a failure and the people who said that it was a success. And you choose what aspect of reality you're going to look at based on what you believe is possible. And so a nonviolence person will have that wider outlook and especially be able to see the successes buried in the failures. You know, one such person has come up now in Florida, in Florida. She is the first black prosecutor in the state. She's in Orlando. She's a Democrat. Aramis D. Ayala is her name. And she announced on March 16th that she would no longer seek the death penalty. Now, she's by no means the only prosecutor or governor who has recently decided not to seek the death penalty, but the pushback that she landed herself in is absolutely extraordinary. And I really think everyone should, we should have a petition campaign to send her some support, because she did a dangerous thing, a risky thing. It took some guts, some courage. And it's interesting that she says this was not a moral decision, which, you know, I can see saying that it was not a moral decision. It's based on the facts. Mm-hmm. Well, if you connect the dots and if you saw that, for example, as of the last time I saw the evidence, when you introduce the death penalty in a state, the murder rate goes up by 2%, which is perfectly logical in terms of nonviolence. Not logical in terms of the normal deterrence theory that we operate on.
Say more about that, Michael. I'm not sure I follow.
Yeah, yeah. No, because what you're doing is cheapening human life. Mm-hmm. What you're doing is saying we, from the highest level of government, we authorize and legitimate brutality. Mm-hmm. So then how is somebody who's enraged, you know, their handguns all over the place, how is that person going to see the truth when that kind of support has been given to untruth?
Now, Amy, I know that this reminds me of a poem that you wrote about your son at an air show, and that sort of the when he first touched a gun that wasn't an active gun. It was no longer able to be used as such. But it's that moment, that seed moment of the imagination of innocence being given a tool of destruction. Is that something that you could share with our listeners?
Yeah, I could. We went to the air show, and the background of the poem is I try to not put a lot of charge into the issue of guns with my children. I try to not legislate in my house. I try. I don't always succeed. But this has been somewhere that's been very tricky for me because of my beliefs and feelings and commitments around militarism. Like, I actually have another poem called I Don't Let My Children Wear Camouflage, which is true. My husband and I agreed when they were born. No, we don't believe that children belong in their everyday clothes should not be supporting this bigger culture of militarism. So we actively have made decisions around this. So then we went to this air show because my husband's an engineer. My kids both have that in them, that engineering mind, and love airplanes and technology. And he stepped up to a Vietnam-era helicopter and got his hands for the first time on this machine gun. I tried, again, not to have a lot of charge around it, but lots of stuff was coming up, and I ended up going home and writing this poem, which is called On Remaining Neutral While Your 5-Year-Old Handles a Gun. It takes practice, it must, to find just the right balance, the right way to sift, to modulate energy, attitude, so he won't walk back to the car, eyes glued to asphalt, filled with rapture or steeped in judgment after touching that thing. You want him to be infused with nothing but sky. The barrel is propped, mounted, I guess, on the edge of a Vietnam copter. A boy in fatigues keeps watch, with a personal airsoft lazily tossed beneath the seat of the vintage machine he's been left with. A boy in fatigues, left with a Vietnam copter. The gun's metal is dull, not the sleek shine your son's mind was led to expect by the small doses of gunplay he's been able to see in his carefully crafted home environment. Softly, softly, he asks, "Mom, what's this?" His small hands lift and lower the gun on its perch, no sign of bullets or battle or death. "A gun," you answer, so cool. His hands flutter a moment, then return with a question. "It won't work anymore," you tell him. Again, so cool. "What was it for?" "For war." 4 days later, up north, one more young man, barely a man, releases his misplaced white-hot vitriol into the bodies of students. Your crafted, elusive equanimity gone, you unloose all your anger and fear of the gun, not in your home, hush, but on Facebook. You even anger your sister-in-law. The way we can walk with such marked restraint amidst casual displays of masculine violence is itself an object of wonder, you think. And while you lie on your bed, frazzled and knowing the sweet, twisted, quite normal joy of kids being kids, while you fervently wish the NRA could truly be sent to a hell you know will never, ever exist, your 5-year-old wanders in, elbows propped, small hands under chin. "Mom, I really want a dart gun. It takes practice."
You're here on Nonviolence Radio, and we're talking with Amy Robinson about the bridge between poetry and the expression of creativity and nonviolence. So, Amy, you just wrote, you've just shared a couple of poems about expressing your the complexity of events such as a child, as a mother, having your child touch a gun for the first time, for example. Do you want to say anything about how poetry has been of benefit to you? It's a bit of a softball question.
Well, it's helped me come alive. That's a big answer, but it really feels true for me. It's funny, I have a whole collection of poems in front of me by other people that that touch on issues that are alive right now in the world or that can help us walk through what's happening in the world right now. And I kind of sat down this morning and just was like jotting a list of like, what is it that these poems do? What are the things that they do? And so the list I came up with was witness. They're poems of witness, just saying what's going on. Poems thrive, poems that help us thrive in these times, even when we're scared, even when we're going through unimaginable things. Poems that empathize, poems that remember. And then I got stuck on this word act. It's the last on my list. And I was like, why? It struck me that not many of the poems are literally about going into the streets, like are taking the action. And I realized, oh, that's because the poem itself is the act. Mm. So for me, like it never really was a big hurdle for me to get in the streets. You know, I was in the street for like a year with Occupy, like literally sitting on the concrete in meetings and going to protests. But it was a really big hurdle for me to find my voice and to find a voice that felt like it had integrity and that brought me joy and to be okay with that, to be okay with having that joy. And for that to be the action and to accept that that action is part of the tapestry of what we need.
Well, and so many people write opinion pieces and write articles, which are words and words and words and words that finally, you know, the point is we get it to the point. We have to ask, you know, what's their conception of human nature behind what they're writing? What solutions are they proposing? What's the energy behind what they're writing? And as people's attention, I'm thinking about the attention span of folks who don't sit down anymore and do the long reads. You know, there's something called long reads now, you know,
right,
because it's
right.
going to take you 15 minutes to read this one. You know, it's a long read. So it's almost that poetry is really on the cusp of coming out in the world in a much more practical and useful way than perhaps ever before, especially as we're searching for the words to describe new experiences because we are in a world that hasn't been experienced before. Yeah. Michael?
It strikes me, Amy, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, that one very useful thing that poets can do and other writers is to allow us to penetrate through the smokescreen of euphemism
mm-hmm.
and see something for what it really is without necessarily being devastated by it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I remember that in 1956, I think, they in Germany, in Berlin, they took the Diary of Anne Frank and made it into a play. And they performed this play, and at the end, the audience could not move. They couldn't applaud. They couldn't get up and walk out. They were absolutely devastated. Some years later, you were able to introduce them to what had happened without that personal feeling of their own personal guilt. And I'm thinking, I guess, of Thich Nhat Hanh's poem about that 12-year-old Vietnamese girl who has to commit suicide because mm-hmm. of what's been done to her, that it enables you to really feel the human mm-hmm. loss mm-hmm. in a situation.
Mm-hmm.
And what an awakening that is.
I had the amazing good fortune the weekend right after the election to go on a poetry retreat with Jane Hirschfield. Mm-hmm. And at first I was like, I don't want to stay with my family. I can't go away. This is horrible timing. But it was so amazing to have her. And one of the things that she said was that before you say yes or no, you have to feel the blow. You have to touch the actual. So that's one of the things that poets can do, is to help people touch the actual and then move forward instead of move forward unconsciously.
Mm. Yeah. Well said.
And I'm thinking about Gandhi as well. And he had Rabindranath Tagore, poet laureate of India, was so in Sarojini Naidu, poet, walking with him mm-hmm, to pick up mm-hmm. the salt at this. I mean, so I think we're really onto something here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Michael, give us a little bit more inspiration from the news, then we can tie some more together.
Right. Well, it's not easy to find it out there if you're going through the commercial media, but with the various sources that we have gleaned, happy to share with you that the United Nations nuclear ban discussion started on Monday. There are 113 or more countries that are part of the negotiations, and what they're trying to create is, quote, a legally binding instrument to prohibit nuclear weapons, leading towards their total elimination. Needless to say, well, there are 40-some countries who are not participating, and they're conspicuously not participating. And I will leave you, gentle listeners, to guess which country is leading that countercharge. But I've often mentioned as part of the news that there are new constituencies that have come into the movement, and that's a very hopeful thing. And I found out about one this week. That's called the religious left. It's emerging as a political force. On just recently, March 27th, this news came out that since the election of the president, there have been monthly lectures on social justice at the 600-seat Gothic Chapel of New York's Union Theological Seminary. And they have been filled to capacity with crowds three times what they usually draw. In January, this Manhattan Graduate School turned away about 1,000 people from a lecture on mass incarceration. And as a person who is names himself as spiritual but not religious, I hope I'll be forgiven for saying that I think this could be of tremendous benefit to religious establishments as well as to the movement. One other thing I might mention is we like to report to you from time to time from our friend Rajiv Vora, who is carrying out a very courageous and very well-designed program, two programs actually, in Bihar and in the Maoist insurgency tribal areas there and in Kashmir. And he writes that there are drastic reductions in radicalization, which talk about euphemisms. Radicalization means conversion to violence, of course. Drastic reductions in that he has seen in his group. And what they only do, really, is get them to read Hind Swaraj, Gandhi's classic of 1909. And he writes, it can be safely said today that in India, his organization called Swaraj Peet is the only experiment in nonviolence of its kind, testing nonviolence in hard areas. So your support for Swaraj Peet would have very high added value.
And in Gandhi's book, Hind Swaraj, it was a book that he wrote early in his career, after his work in South Africa, so we're looking around 1909. So Satyagraha then has, or nonviolent resistance, Satyagraha has been declared in South Africa a couple of years before, and he's on an ocean liner back to India. Has plenty of time to make himself to express himself, and he expresses himself in a bit of a platonic dialogue where there's the editor and the reader, and he asks, you know, sort of FAQ kind of thing. It's like he's all the questions that he's had, and it's a book that's really takes on empire itself point by point, from the way, from relationships to the way that medicine is done, to the way that I mean, just everything. And it's a book that underneath of it really gives you a picture that Gandhi wasn't just this peaceful meditator saying namaste and be the change. He was channeling anger and indignation into nonviolent action, because that book makes it very clear that he was quite upset. Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't think he ever did say, be the change you want to see in the world.
I know. It's just, you know what
but,
people think,
yes,
when they think
I know.
Of Gandhi.
But interestingly, what he wrote that book in response to having met some radical Indians in London who were threatening to take up the gun. And that scared him more than the Raj, because he felt that would ruin everything. So he had to really, really get to the heart of nonviolence. And it's interesting that 30 years later, they reissued the book, and he didn't change a word. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting that the book came out in Gujarati, and the British regime banned it. So they brought it out in English, which, of course, made it reached 10 times or 100 times more people. Mm-hmm. You know, today, in addition to Poetry Month coming up, you know, I hope to get back to some of your beautiful verse in a minute, Amy. But in addition to that, this is Cesar Chavez Day. Mm-hmm. And we are going to probably share something more about Cesario Chavez with you in a subsequent program. But in April of 1978, he gave a beautiful speech, which the Mary Knoll Center has reprinted, and which was put online by something called Greater Good, which I would recommend all of those. So let me read you a little bit from that speech in honor of him. So he writes, or said, in honoring Martin Luther King Jr.'s memory, we also acknowledge nonviolence as a truly powerful weapon to achieve equality and liberation. In fact, the only weapon that Christians who struggle for social change can claim as their own. We are also convinced that nonviolence is more powerful than violence. Nonviolence supports you if you have a just and moral cause. Nonviolence provides the opportunity to stay on the offensive, and that is of critical importance to win any contest. I'd like to pause there for a minute because of our situation, God help us, so much of what we're doing is reactive. And I think it was Paul and Mark Engler, or no, it was George Lakey, who said, we'll never get anywhere by being on the defensive. Let's, instead of defending Obamacare, for example, let's go on now to single payer, which is actually happening in some quarters.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, I've also heard you say, I think it was in Search for Nonviolent Future, your book from 2001. But it was reissued and you printed it again, right, in 2004 or something. Mm-hmm. But you said in the beginning of the book, you're talking about walking on campus and seeing a sign, a group of students talking about anti-Asian hate crimes on the rise. And you said you knew that in order to understand what was going on, you had to first get beyond your initial reaction. So that's how I understand the sort of defensive action as well. Like having enough security and insight to be able to get a hold of yourself before responding or reacting. So you pause, and then you said, and then you started to take steps back from anti-Asian hate crimes to hate crimes to hate itself, for example. Amy, I wonder if you have something to say about this, because you're a Zen practitioner, and you this also kind of came about with the poetry and activism all and your spiritual practice all at once. Have you experienced this too, that practice can help get an initial reaction? I don't want to say under control, but you get to see it before it comes out of you without reflection, or that you feel more reflective when you do act.
Definitely. I mean, it doesn't mean having a regular meditation or spiritual practice doesn't mean for me that I never act unconsciously, obviously, habitually. But yes, there definitely are moments when I can catch myself, or I'm more self-aware about if I'm spreading myself thin, if I'm acting defensively. It's interesting that you bring up George Lakey, because soon after the election, that I remember exactly reading him saying that, you know, that can we have a politics of vision, not just a politics of reaction? Mm. And also, I think a lot about caregiving and how little that's valued in our society, and how that also can form a frame or a backbone for a politics of vision, you know, that we are taking care of each other as we move forward. Yeah. Not just holding the line where it is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I should really close this talk of Cesar Chavez with a point that's right on what we've just been saying. Just listen to this. He said, we're going to spend the rest of our lives building our union. For us, there is nowhere else to go. And then he says, although we would like to see victory come soon, we are willing to wait. In this sense, time is our ally. Mm. We learned many years ago that the rich may have money, but the poor have time. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that is an important piece of nonviolence, is thinking about time. And part of our initial reaction, too, I speak for myself, I suppose, but is impatience, wanting to see the results take place immediately, and how to begin to grow a deeper perspective of the whole, and to hold back one's desire to grasp on to a result right away and to get what we want. It seems like when we get what we want, there's so much of an edge of coercion in it that we can't really even enjoy that thing that we wanted as much. It has to be it has to be ripe, it has to be ready. And that, I think that spans from personal relationships to spiritual insights to social change as well. It's that, which is a challenging statement to make because there are things that do need to change right away. And it's like these little actions that we take every single day, it seems like it's taking forever. But in the long term, we have to be making those actions every day. And then we see that it took a couple months or it took 3 years. That wasn't that long if we didn't make those actions every day. Mm-hmm. So I think that, yes, I think it's a fascinating conversation. We should turn an entire show over to the concept of time and nonviolence. Amy, you're nodding.
I have a poem for you. Not one of my own, actually. Well, two. I mean, one is a poem that I found that weekend that I was with Jean Hirschfield, and it's in her collection of spiritual poetry by women. Which the title of which is completely escaping me right now. But and it's by Hadewich, I think that's how you say it, of Antwerp. Hadewich of Antwerp. And this poem just floored me that weekend when I was just like, we have to do something. You know, why am I sitting in a room with 50 poets?
Wow.
You know, we have to do something. And this poem, which was written centuries ago, is called Love's Maturity. In the beginning, love satisfies us. When love first spoke to me of love, how I laughed at her in return. But then she made me like the hazel trees, which blossom early in the season of darkness and bear fruit slowly. And those last two lines, I just like became my mantra, my companion for a while after that. She made me like the hazel trees, which blossom early in the season of darkness and bear fruit slowly. They just let me accept that we may be in a season of darkness and that we might not see the results soon.
I'm remembering, Amy, the famous formula that Joanna Macy came up with, that we have to build new institutions, we have to change the culture, and we have to stop the worst of the damage. Mm-hmm. So by landing always on stop the worst of the damage right now and forgetting to build what's called prefigurative action, where you build what you want in the future without waiting for someone to give it to you. It's an important part of constructive program. By getting frantically caught up in this reactive mode and forgetting to do those other two things, we lose the future. And in my more cynical moments, and yes, I have some, I almost think that they're doing that purposely. They're giving us something that will freak us out and distract us from the structural issues, from the cultural problem.
Can I read another poem?
Please.
Okay.
Please. Yeah, I'm starting to sense that we should have a resident poet on Nonviolence Radio. You're welcome to come anytime.
So this is Denise Levertov, and she actually wrote this for Karen Silkwood, and I think I don't know if it was first published, but it was definitely published in the War Resisters League magazine. And it's so relevant right now.
Who was Karen Silkwood?
Karen Silkwood. She exposed the nuclear disaster.
Yeah.
I actually saw that movie when I was like 8, I think. Yeah. And but this poem is really beautiful. It's called Beginners, and it's about what you were just saying. But we have only begun to love the earth. We have only begun to imagine the fullness of life. How could we tire of hope? So much is in bud. How can desire fail? We have only begun to imagine justice and mercy, only begun to envision how it might be to live as siblings with beast and flower, not as oppressors. Surely our river cannot already be hastening into the sea of non-being. Surely it cannot drag in the silt all that is innocent. Not yet, not yet. There is too much broken that must be mended. Too much hurt we have done to each other that cannot yet be forgiven. We have only begun to know the power that is in us if we would join our solitudes in the communion of struggle. So much is unfolding that must complete its gesture. So much is in bud.
That is beautiful. So much is in bud. Well, we don't have a lot of time, and I need to wrap up with some of the upcoming events. And I think I'll only mention that since I'm swamped and caught up in the present and can't keep track of them all, there's a wonderful resource now. If you go to PaceEBene/CNV, which stands for Campaign Nonviolence, on their homepage in the right-hand column, incidentally, when you're there, look at check out the recommended books, because the last recommended book is the Nonviolence Handbook by your humble servant. But in the right-hand column, they have a lot of the upcoming events. They're trying to keep their finger on the pulse of the nation. And it's not that you have to know what every one of them is, but you will be so thrilled by the amount and the variety of things that are going on. Now, Paul and Mark Engler have written a beautiful, very thoughtful article in Waging Nonviolence on how to bring all of these things together and stop regarding one another as competitors and stop saying your approach is wrong, my approach is right. But what is the role of yours and what is the role of mine? And their article is about what a genius Gandhi was at doing this. So at Stanford, which as a Berkeley man, I feel is very nonviolent of me to mention this, but our good friend Clay Carson, Claiborne Carson, is on April 4th, coming up soon, putting on a conference in their auditorium there on with Tavis Smiley and Clarence B. Jones on nonviolence and justice, social justice. And finally, a little bit after that, on the 9th, Sunday afternoon, there's one of the many, many training workshops that are going on. You know, we've been saying that we need two things for the movement to happen, at least. We need training and we need strategy. So training is happening all over the place. Strategy, I think we need to work on a little bit more.
An expression. Creative expression.
Creative expression, so that we can see why we are training and create a useful strategy out of that. Absolutely. But anyway, in the Wiltern Theater in San Francisco on Sunday afternoon, there will be a program entitled Stand Up and Fight Back, Tactics for Effective Creative Activism. It's a free 3-hour workshop, and this is the punchline, if you will. We need a nonviolent equivalent to that expression. This is the pat line. It'll be a free workshop taught by two of the nation's leading nonviolent practitioners, Nadine Block and the Reverend Jim Lawson.
Wow, that's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
That'll be awesome. So you've been listening to Nonviolence Radio, and that's Michael Negler with all of our news that we've been incorporating and weaving into our program today. And we've had as our guest today, Amy Robinson, local activist and local poet and mother and Zen practitioner and partner and friend. So Amy, would you like to tell us, okay, people can get your poetry and find your writings on turningplanet.org.
Yeah.
And I love the title of your blog. It says Still Mind.
Still Life. Turning Planet.
Turning Planet.
Yeah.
For some reason, I thought Still Mind, Turning Planet, but both work for me.
Right.
Very Zen.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us on Nonviolence Radio.
Thank you so much.
You back. Yeah. And we want to thank our mother station, KWMR, all of our listeners, all of the staff and friends at the Meta Center for Nonviolence, and to everybody else. Until the next time, take care of one another.